Good morning, and welcome to Community Conversations on 88.5 KRFY. We air the show each Tuesday and Thursday at 8 a.m. with recorded interviews on local issues. Community Conversations is actually an interim show that is filling in for our usual morning show until we are a little farther past the coronavirus precautions that have closed the KRFY studio for live interviews. I'm Chris Bessler, the host today, and our show today is a look at the primary election, which just concluded Tuesday, June 2nd. We go over the election results with three individuals providing their analysis of how the vote went. Our distinguished panel today are County Clerk and Chief Election Officer Michael Rosedale, Sandpoint Reader Editor Zach Hagedone, and Bonner County Daily Bee Publisher Bill Davis. Our contested local primary races were all on the Republican side of the ballot, but our conversation includes a look at results in some of the statewide races, plus a look ahead at the races that are now firmed up for the November general election. With that, let's get started with this community conversation.
Okay, we are live now with three individuals who are going to help us parse the election results. Michael Rosedale, he's Bonner County Clerk and our Chief Election Officer. Michael, thanks for being on with us.
Thanks for having me.
As well, we have Zach Hagedone. He's editor of the Sandpoint Reader. Zach, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Bill Davis, he's publisher of the Bonner County Daily Bee. Bill, thank you for weighing in via Zoom this morning.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm going to rattle off the local results because we had three contested races basically here locally and not to keep people waiting on those. And then we'll back up and we'll talk about each of these races, other races statewide. We'll talk about the overall turnout for this race because it was dramatically impacted by absentee balloting this year. And then we'll maybe take a few guesses at what might come in the general election in November. So for our primary election results in our local contested races for District 1 Bonner County Commissioner, Stephen Bradshaw beat challenger Butch Horton by 4,849 votes to 2,445 votes. For State Representative Seat B in Legislative District 1, which does include Boundary County, Sage Dixon won both in the Bonner County vote, but for the entire district, he won rather handily over his opponent, Gary Supiger. Sage received 6,738 votes to Gary's 1,910 votes. That's the entire district, not just Bonner County. And then in Legislative District 7, which is this district that stretches all the way from Sagal down to Riggins, our local candidate Cornell Razor, he won Bonner County in the vote for the state representative seat there, but he lost district-wide to Charlie Shepard of Riggins. Cornell Razor received 4,051 votes to Shepard's 4,414 votes. So that was a close race. With that, let's jump in with each of these individual races, and let's talk first about that Bonner County commissioner race. And let's start with you, Zach, from your seat in the media room there at the Sandpoint Reader. What did you see on that race that you thought was interesting? And Bradshaw, of course, was the incumbent, and he won by a rather handy number. What do you think the factors were there?
Well, I mean, Steve Bradshaw is clearly a very well-liked individual. He's got he leverages a lot of his church membership. He's very active in the religious community. I think he's got a built-in constituency there. I thought Butch Horton was a really strong candidate. Of course, in these kind of primary races, it's all about who can out-conservative whom. And I thought Butch had some pretty good arguments. I was a little bit surprised, actually, that Bradshaw beat him as handily as he did. But I think that really speaks to the power of incumbency and the power of that constituency that he has sort of built in through his faith community. Honestly, that was the one that surprised me the most. I thought it would have been closer. I thought that Butch mounted a really good campaign. I certainly saw his message out all over the place. And, you know, Steve, he campaigned to the people that he wanted to campaign to. And clearly it worked.
Yes, it definitely does speak to the power of incumbency. Bill, do you have any insights on that particular race that you observed that might have, resulted in this kind of lopsided victory for Mr. Bradshaw?
I agree that Stephen Bradshaw was the more popular of the candidates. At least the folks that I spoke with seemed to mention his name much more often. I think Butch did wage a good campaign. I just don't think he was as well known as Mr. Bradshaw. And so I think as an incumbent, I think he had a very strong advantage.
Michael, you're in the county administrative building there, and you work with Mr. Bradshaw, Stephen Bradshaw. Do you have any insights on that particular race, what you might have observed?
You know, I've had my nose to the grindstone with this election. I'm sort of agnostic as far as politics when it comes to who's going to win and all that kind of stuff. I agree with Zach and Bill probably on a lot of what they said. I think one of the reasons that, Steve did win, I think a lot of people like some of his stance on some of the things. I know that probably the city of Sandpoint didn't like it maybe as much as the rural areas like some of his stances, but basically I agree with what they said. He is the incumbent. He has a better known name, and generally he got, one-third, two-thirds. Of course, one-third, two-thirds, that just proves out what everybody else has said. I mean, he's just better known, I think, is the thing.
Yeah, I'd echo that. Butch Horton hasn't lived here that long, and the fact that Stephen has been here for so long, that was definitely an advantage for him as well. You live in a town long enough, you get to know an awful lot of people. So let's turn to the state representative for Legislative District 1, Seat B, and that was the incumbent Sage Dixon. And if we take a look at the, I guess we should look at the Bonner County results on that. He won the district by a pretty lopsided number. Sage won by three times the votes, really, for Gary. And in Bonner County, I don't think it was quite that lopsided, but it was still the vote in Bonner County. I'm looking this up as we speak here.
It was 3-1. 3-1 in Bonner County.
Yeah, it was 3-1 in Bonner County. Okay, so that's reflective of what he got throughout the district, including Boundary County.
I'm curious how it'll play out in the end against Howlett as a Republican candidate. Love to hear your all thoughts on that.
Yeah, so that this sets up Sage to come up in the general election against the Democrat, Stephen Howlett. But let's back up and talk about this Republican primary race. Zach, I think we had a pretty clear difference there that in this race, I perceived Gary as probably more moderate than Sage, perhaps. And Sage, he's been in, I think, for this is his third time he's coming up for election now. So he has had that opportunity to work with his constituents and build up, the power of the incumbency there. Zach,
sure. So the thing with Gary, his campaign was really single issue, which I think might have hurt him in the end. He really hammered home this idea of education funding. And that's kind of where he comes from, being a Lake Pontarre School District trustee, volunteering at my alma mater, Sagal Elementary School, Sagal Hawks for many years. So he's an education guy, and that's really what he ran on. And Sage has, been in the state house for a long time, and so he's managed to put his hands on a lot of different issues, so he can speak to a lot of different issues. And I don't know that Gary could really effectively message anything other than education. He was very good on education. I think that he ran a very effective education campaign. And when I spoke with him, I said, why don't you run for state superintendent of schools? Like, clearly that's where your interests are and where your expertise is. And he said, well, I wanted to be in the state house. But I think, combined with the power of incumbency and also Gary's sort of single issue campaign, I wasn't super surprised, so to speak, by how that went. Sage is very popular. He's a reasonable guy. He's very accessible. He'll talk to anyone for however long they want to talk to him. He doesn't come off as much of an ideologue as some of his colleagues, despite the fact that he may hold some of the similar views. And again, just like Steve Bradshaw, he's got a faith community that he can tap into. I know he's also very, he's a very devout person. He is very active in his church. So again, you see power incumbency, you see power of, you know, a built-in constituency. And then the fact that, you know, he's been out there and he's done a lot of stuff, and his opponent in the primary really just kind of stuck to that one issue of education. And that turns on some people, but it also just doesn't really carry, you know, for a statewide race or a legislative race.
Bill, you have any analysis on that race?
Not any different than Zach. I do agree that Gary was very strong on the education piece. I think, you know, it was well stated that that Sage is much broader in terms of his involvement in different issues and different expertise. I'll go so far as to say I think Sage out-marketed Gary as well.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Michael, any feedback on that race?
A couple things. One is I would say that in this race, unlike the Steve Bradshaw race, I think Gary Supiger was well known. So it was, you know, they're both popular in different realms. I would agree with Zach that, and Bill, that Sage is sort of a level-headed, even-keeled guy. And, you know, that's one of the things that people like about Sage. I don't really know much about Gary personally. My kids were out of the nest by the time we got here 12 years ago. But I know that Sage is an even-keeled guy and level-headed. So I think people really respect that. And this is his fourth time running. And on that note, what a pain. I mean, every 2 years to re-up. I mean, what a...
Yeah,
I don't. That's probably a good thing and a bad thing, but that's tough. Every 2 years, they have to get those gears in motion again, and I mean, it's tough. It's hard. I don't know. It would be a lifestyle I would not want.
Yeah. Well, I'll say this for the every 2 year election: is it keeps them on their toes because they become
sure.
To the voters, but it, on their side, it is an awful lot of work. And of course, that's true even for the state senate races. We didn't have any contested primaries for the state Senate race. Jim Woodward was the single Republican candidate. And who's the Democratic candidate?
Vera Gadman.
Vera Gadman will face him on the Democratic side in November. But neither of them were contested in this race, so they had an easy go. But I'll echo that, Michael. Yeah, it's an awful lot of work to campaign every 2 years. And I will also echo, you know, Zach and Bill, that one thing about Sage is he maintains his accessibility to the voters and the media and everybody. So he's willing to talk to you. At the end of the day, you may or may not agree with the position he takes, but he'll tell you why he's taking that position and he'll hear you out. So.
Well,
I think voters do appreciate that.
I mean, honestly, it's a very shrewd strategy as well, because he can stake a claim in pretty, you know, extreme positions sometimes, and he won't take the flack for it because he remains accessible. I can think of some of his other colleagues in the legislature who will, you know, take stances on things like child marriage and, you know, you name it, like all these social justice, social issue kind of things the legislature likes to bog themselves down with. And he won't. He's kind of the Teflon man. Sometimes he can say stuff, and then it just slides right off. He doesn't become controversial, and that's really to his credit, I guess, as a politician, that he's able to do that.
Yeah, well, it's certainly to his credit that he'll talk to you and explain his position on stuff. But and he's the proof's in the pudding. He won by a 3-1 vote there in that primary election. All right, let's talk about Legislative District 7. This is kind of the most problematic district in the whole state, if you ask me, because it's it stretches well over 200 miles from, you know, just south of the Long Bridge all the way down to below Riggins on the east side of Highway 95 for most of that. And in that race, again, Cornell Razor lost to Charlie Shepard. Cornell Razor being a former Bonner County commissioner, he did win quite handily up here in Bonner County. He received 840 votes in Bonner County to Charlie Shepard's 280 votes. Charlie lives in Riggins again. But Cornell lost district-wide by not that many votes. He received 4,051 votes to Shepard's 4,414 votes. I guess it raises the question, can a candidate from this northern part of that long district even win? Because it's so spread out, and the more of the population is further down south. Zach, what do you think about the District 7 race?
Well, I mean, I've spent about half my life living in Boise and areas in, you know, south of Lucille, Idaho, which according to the United States Geological Survey is the literal definition of North and South Idaho. So once you go north of Lucille, you're in North Idaho. Go south of Lucille, you're South Idaho. And that's right around the Riggins area. And they really are two different worlds. I'm actually sort of amazed that it was as close as it was. Honestly, I mean, I would not have been surprised at all that Cornell did as well as he did here in Bonner County. I think he's a native. I'm pretty sure my dad went to high school with him. Like, I've known of Cornell my entire life. Everyone in town knows him. He's clearly been a longtime political actor. He was Bonner County Republican Central Committee chairman for a while. So he's in the party. He's also in like the public face. He's got his store downtown. That doesn't surprise me at all. I figured he would have been destroyed by anyone south of, you know, sort of that invisible north-south line. So the fact that it was that close, I think, is actually telling that the message of North Idaho politicians is actually sort of gaining some resonance farther and farther south. I think a North Idaho politician could win in the south of the state based on this race.
Okay. Bill, you got any insights on this District 7 state representative race?
Well, so that's a lot of geography, right? And at least locally speaking, Cornell is very, very popular. I can't speak to the south of Idaho. I'm new to Idaho as of last November. I can't speak to the south side. All I can say is that that's an awful lot of geography, and I am kind of surprised that it's that it reached as far as it did with the success that it did. But I'm not surprised at all locally.
So, yeah. Michael, weigh in on this one. What do you see from your viewpoint?
Well, I think Zach has the best historical perspective on everything with his father going to school with Cornell and the geography. Sure. I expected Cornell to win up here. I know Cornell. He's a great guy. And when I saw the early results from our county, I thought for sure he probably won. But I don't have Zach's perspective of, you know, the north-south, the Mason-Dixon line, whatever that is. I don't know. But anyway, that I don't have that perspective. And for sure it played out. I thought with a 3-1 margin here, it would be pretty tough for a candidate to lose overall, but, you know, there is a difference. And as you get, you know, south of the line, politics do change. And I was surprised, but true to form, I mean, that's part of the game, right? I mean, you have different constituents in different areas of the state, and that's how it plays out.
Yeah, that's one district I'd actually like to see. We're going to be into redistricting here after the census, and that's one district I think should be corrected because it doesn't serve these communities when they're so spread out. They don't have communities of common interests or common needs, and to have one representative covering such a huge district is not ideal for the citizens of that district, in my opinion.
Chris, on that note, I have a feeling after the census being done this year, they have to draw these districts perhaps, I don't know if they will or not based on what the results are, but that may be remedied, you know, later this year or next year when they redraw the districts, if they do.
Yeah, I for the folks that live in that district, I hope they do put the make it a smaller district so they have, you know, communities of common interest and can have a better chance to elect a representative that will be kind of more embedded in those common interests. I will say for this one, you know, with Cornell coming so close, I think it shows all the years and years that he's been active in the Republican Party definitely helped him down south. Mm-hmm. And I think he's had a good profile down south. I think he probably campaigned down there pretty hard. And between those two candidates, we interviewed both of them for KRFY. They did not have a big difference in their positions. They were really pretty lockstep on almost all the positions that we discussed. And I think it boiled down to voters probably going with the guy closest to them. You know, that's always a factor in voting. And so,
Chris, on that note, something Zach or Bill said was, you know, one of the things about Sage is that he's accessible and you can talk to him whether or not you agree with him or not, he's accessible. In District 7, accessibility is a huge issue, as you were alluding to. Actually meeting or having a face-to-face contact with that representative is impossible almost.
Yeah. So. Up here, especially when the guy lives, so, you know, Charlie Shepard lives in Riggins. You got to drive for about 4 hours to see your representative.
Right.
If you live in Sagal, so it's quite a spread out district. We'll see what happens coming up in the redistricting if that gets remedied in some way. So let's talk. Those were the contested local races. They were all Republican. There weren't any contested local races on the Democratic ticket. But let's talk about the turnout because this election was so different in the way we voted. We were all voting absentee because of the coronavirus and the precautions that have been taken for that. Michael, why don't you fill us in on the numbers of people that requested absentee ballots and the numbers you actually got back and, you know, what your take is on that?
Yeah, so we had every election we have absentees that are requested that aren't returned, and you don't know why they weren't returned. We had more unreturned this time than I was hoping. I was hoping we'd have more returned. But we had roughly 15,000 ballots requested. We had returned 10,800, 803 to be exact. So it's a combination of, why they weren't returned, I don't know. Some people request those ballots first thing every year, absentees, and so those that requested them in January or February may not even been around or didn't care about this one. They want to just vote in November. Some people may have requested and just were not interested. They may have actually requested the nonpartisan, which was a little bit deflating. When you got a nonpartisan ballot, it was a ballot without any partisan race, so it was just judicial confirmations or the recall for Priest Lake Library or something like that. And they may have just been, you know, felt disenfranchised by what they had asked for, but they got what they asked for. So that's another reason. Another thing would be that we had a federal court order to extend the date to request the absentee ballot until May 26th, and that was just last Tuesday night at 8 o'clock. We got the ballots out on May 26th as they were coming in the morning, and then after the mail went out on May 26th, we got those that came in through 8 o'clock out first thing on the 27th. And if you do the math, that makes an impossible situation. We got them out as early as possible, as technically available. We got them out the next morning. And some people, it's conceivable, got them and they tried to mail them back, which would have not have worked. Or, you know how the mail is. Every once in a while, it's really late. Our mail goes to Spokane primarily. And so it may not have even been delivered by yesterday. And so that's another possibility. But on that note, we still had a huge turnout. 4 years ago, which would be the comparable election, we had 32% turnout. This one we had, 40 or 38%, so it was a higher percentage turnout. We had 10,803 people vote last four years ago. We had 7,300 people vote. So it was more. I thought it would be even more than that, but it was still a good turnout, considering we had insane situation with the COVID-19 and mail-only ballots and all this hoopla. It was quite the ride for my offices, that's for sure.
Yeah. Bill or Zach, any observations on the whole absentee balloting and the turnout?
Well, I think the first thing I want to say is kudos to Mike's office for that and being so flexible and adaptable and making that work. I'm floored that you all were able to pull that off. I've said it before, so I just want to reiterate, like, the real heroes here are the election workers at the county for making this actually happen.
I have an awesome team. They worked every weekend for the last month and were here late till 7 or 8 at night, many nights. So anyway, thank you. I appreciate that acknowledgement. They did a great job.
Hey, Mike, I'm curious, how did we calculate the votes so quickly overnight?
Oh, that's easy. Since it was mail only, what we're able to do is when they come in, if anybody, I'm sure you all filled out your ballots, but they're in double envelopes. So we won those to make, and then when we scan the back of the envelope where you sign, and I'm telling you more than what you asked for, but this is for everybody's benefit. The little barcode, your signature pops up on our screen. So we can verify that you actually voted that ballot. It wasn't stolen and returned by somebody else. So once we do that and we put them in alphabetical order and it registers that you actually voted that election, then we can actually open and take the yellow ballots out of the white ballots, white envelopes, separate those so we don't know which ballot goes with which, you know, person's name. And then we are able to, over the last week, actually starting Thursday, open the yellow envelopes, pull out the ballots, scan them onto, we have a our election equipment, we're able to scan those photographs, the images, onto their proprietary thumb drives that can't be used anywhere else. So those were done, and the resolutions with write-ins and all those were done ahead of time. So at 8 o'clock, so that took the course of basically 4 days, Thursday, Friday, Monday, and all day yesterday, to open those ballots and run those through our scanner just like we do election night, but we start much later on election night normally. So that's how we got the head start on that. We started Thursday night. But we did not have the results. We have a separate machine then that actually tallies those, and by law, we can't put those drives into the tally machine until 8 o'clock, and so that's why we had to wait till 8 o'clock to give any kind of result. Statewide, it's that law.
Well, thank you for that. I think it's fascinating. You got to love that. From an accuracy standpoint, are there any advantages to the traditional way of voting versus the absentee ballot?
You know, I hate to say this, but accuracy wise, the mail-only ballots are far more accurate than polling place, because what happens when people request a ballot, the staff I have in elections are the pros. They know if you're eligible. They know what ID you need, how to prove your residence, which ballot you're eligible for, which district you're in. And so that is very precise. And when those come back, we check the back against your signature for every signed envelope. So there's that. When the regular method is great because people see you, they could challenge you, say you're not Joe Schmo or whatever, but we have over 200 volunteers that it's impossible to be up to speed on all the laws. And you can have somebody walk up and say, you know, but I've always voted here my whole life and I vote in the city elections every time, and they don't live in the city, and you could pressure a poll worker to, you know, give you the wrong ballot. And I'm not saying that happens very often, but it could happen. And so in a way, it's way more work for my office to do the mail-only ballots, but it's probably technically more accurate. And on that note, let me go back to the last question, why we didn't have the turnout of the ballots. A lot of ballots came back without signatures, and we couldn't contact the people. And by law, if we don't have signatures on that ballot, or if the signatures don't match, and we can't get a hold of the people to ask them if they actually voted the ballot, we cannot count the ballots. So we have a stack of ballots that we were not able to scan, and that accounts for, you know, some of those missing numbers. But that's part of our safety process, is that if they don't sign the ballot, which is by law required, we cannot scan those. We cannot count those ballots.
So, Mike, I just wanted to confirm real quick here. I heard some numbers, and I just want to make sure I got them down right. You said 15,000 or so requested, 10,803 returned. Is that right?
Yes. 10,803 were valid returns. We had more returns than that. Right. Correct.
Michael, what do you predict is going to happen for this November election? Do you think it'll be all absentee voting again, or will we open the polls back up?
Well, there's a two-pronged question there. One is, I think you're saying, what do you think the state's going to do? I don't know. I sure hope we don't have this mandatory absentee, because it is really onerous on us. However, I think we're going to have a lot of people vote absentee simply because when they requested their absentee ballot for this election, there is a place to mark May, August, and November, and I think people just marked every box. So we're going to get a boatload in November of absentees. Whether they're required to or not, I don't know, but I hope we have regular polling places open, because in addition to the election itself, that's a huge community event, and it's a great camaraderie thing. No matter what party you're on, it's always good to see everybody there four times a year. I think there's value there above and beyond just the election, and I hope for people that want to vote at the polling place that they're able to vote at the polling place.
Okay.
So if I could just jump in real quick, one observation I had about the whole mail-in balloting was what was really strange about this election cycle is that politicians were not able to politic in the way that they usually have, you know, door knocking, having events, you know, there was no rallies and all this kind of thing.
It's true.
And, right.
And you would think that in an environment like that, where politicians weren't able to politic, you would have a low turnout. And then to see this, you know, huge ballot request turnout anyway, speaks to me anyway of kind of the power of social media and of the alternative ways that candidates can get their message out. They clearly activated the voters, even without the ability to, like, go around and put little signs on your doorknob or whatever. So I think that was a big game changer, realizing that candidates don't need to go door to door anymore to get their message.
You know, on tagging onto that, I think another thing that really brought people out of the woodwork was North Idaho is a pretty freedom loving, and they hold their freedoms and protected you know, constitutional rights close. And I think they've heard stories about what happens with other states absentee voting, and they were very wary about that. And I mean, rightly so. Idaho's absentee voting laws are much more stringent than almost any other states, as far as I know. They are so safeguarded. I mean, down to what I said, with the signature on the back of the envelope, if they don't match with your signature on record, they don't count. Another thing is, every ballot has a barcode. Now, you can't trace that barcode to the person, because we don't match that with your name when we mail it out. But if somebody photocopies their ballot in Idaho, at least in Bonner County, and they you know, they try to stuff the ballot box, so to speak, I don't know how you would do that, but if they try to, our system recognizes that barcode once. After that, they're all void ballots. And so that's another safeguard, and other states don't have that. So back to the comment about, you know, activating our voters, I think that really put everybody on alert, and everybody, you know, it was a wake-up call, slap in the face kind of a thing. Not that it's a bad thing, but everybody was alerted that there was something going on, and they wanted to make sure that it went their way, whichever way that was.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we'll see how it plays out for November at this point. I'd like to turn now. We had a couple of contested statewide races in this for the primary. You know, let's just touch on those real briefly. In the race for United States Senator, the incumbent Republican Jim Risch, he was unopposed. He received statewide 200,000 votes, as you would expect, but being unopposed. And the Democratic side, there was a primary race between Paulette Jordan and Jim Vandermoss. And Paulette Jordan won rather handily there. She got 85% of the vote, 72,777, to Jim Vandermoss getting 12,145. Anything surprising about that race with you, Zach, or Bill, or
Michael? No, no, I was not surprised by that at all.
Yeah, Paulette Jordan had a lot of name recognition going into this.
Paulette's very well known. Yeah, I don't even know who Vandermoss is, to be honest with you.
She's actually run before, but Paulette, her name recognition is huge.
Yeah.
It will be interesting to see what happens in the general election between Paulette and Jim Risch, because I think he's a popular incumbent. And of course, this is a Republican state to start with. So Paulette's got a lot of work to do if she's going to pull that one off.
Well, Risch is known kind of somewhat in the Sage Dixon vein as sort of a steady hand on the tiller. Like Jim Risch is a very even keel guy. He's former interim governor. He sits on the Intelligence Committee. He's a ranking member of the Senate. And I think a lot of Idahoans who are in the know about, you know, politics don't want to give up a ranking member in Congress.
Yeah.
And Paulette's she's very popular. She's very charismatic. She's got a great story. But she'd be coming in as a first timer, you know, and Jim's got all this institutional knowledge. I mean, if I was going to prognosticate, and I don't think I'd be losing any money on a bet here, but Jim's going to be sent back to the Senate.
Paulette's a dark horse. You never know, though. Let's hold out some hope for her supporters. Okay, let's talk about the United States Representative in District 1. Then this is the U.S. Congressional District, so it runs actually from our part of the state all the way down to Boise. Takes in a piece of Boise, I think. In that race, the Republican incumbent, Russ Fulcher, he won very handily again with 79% of the vote over Nicholas Jones, who got 20% of the vote. Nicholas Jones is a young man. I had not been acquainted with him before this race. So it's really not surprising that the incumbent, Fulcher, would win this one either. But anybody got any insights on that one?
Again, just popularity. I personally don't know who Jones is. Fulcher, very popular, marketed well. His name is somewhat of a household name, I suspect.
Well, I mean, in my days back when I was a junior reporter in Boise, I would cover state house stuff, and I first met Russ Fulcher when he was, I think, a lobbyist for the Idaho Department of Transportation. And I've kind of watched his career develop, and he's very affable. He's kind of your standard Southern Idaho gentleman rancher, good old boy, you know, slap you on the back, hearty handshake, wheeler dealer kind of guy. He did have a period of when he was out in the cold in the party when he ran for governor and lost. And I think he had a little bit of sour grapes, but he clearly earned his stripes back with the party. And I think that the Idaho Republican Party is very happy to have Russ in Congress. But I think Nicholas Jones may have kind of stepped in a little bit, because he's the reason why we had this delayed election deadline. Yep. And Mike can speak to that. I mean, Nicholas Jones is the one who filed the lawsuit claiming that people were being disenfranchised, and that's why we had to push the absentee ballot request back to the 26th. And I don't know if that played in the election, but I'm pretty sure that played in the party.
Probably. Yeah, perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in all the county clerk offices across the state, I bet, having to deal with it, moving the election back like that for about a week at the last minute. Okay, so that was the Republican side for the congressional District 1. On the Democratic side, there was a contested primary race as well in Staniela Nicolava. Received 13,000 votes, and Rudy Soto received 25,000 votes, so he won by a 2-1 margin. So Rudy Soto will end up facing Russ Fulcher now in the general election. I don't know, Zach or Bill or Michael, you guys have any insights on that particular race?
I don't.
I mean, I had never heard of either of those people in my life. Yeah. I don't know who they are.
Yeah, so that does not vote for the general election for those guys.
No, I don't think there's very good chances. I mean, Russ really is, he's a part of the party. He's a long time supporter of all the various causes in Idaho. The caucus loves him. Like, it's, and he's starting to make a name for himself up there on Capitol Hill, so I think he's pretty safe.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's now turn towards some prognostications or guesses about what might be coming up the general election, because now we know who will be on the ballot for our local races. And in the Democratic side for Commissioner District 1, Steve Johnson was unopposed, so he's going to be now facing Stephen Bradshaw. And Steve Johnson has run for office a number of times as a Democrat, and he did run for I believe he ran for commissioner in the last election as well. Last time the seat was up. Zach, how do you handicap this race going into the general election?
Well, to be honest, I think we're going to see a repeat of the primary. I think Steve Bradshaw's got that broad base of support. He's got that faith community he can draw on. He's very active in, you know, sort of party politics. He has the power of incumbency. I mean, if I was going to guess, I would just say, you know, Steve Bradshaw is probably going to be retained.
And he has the R behind his name, which right there is a huge, a huge advantage in our, you know, generally Republican county. I don't know, Bill or Michael, if you want to have any insights on that one.
I am in agreement with Zach on that. I think Steve is going to take it. That's what I think.
Yeah, let's not rob hope from the supporters of Steve Johnson. Things happen. A candidate can make a faux pas and create a controversy, and there's always a chance that a dark horse can win these elections.
Well, in this county, controversy wins, though. I mean, part of what's made Steve Bradshaw popular is getting behind this, you know, lawsuit between the county and the city and the festival gun policy. He's been very vocal, sort of claiming that as his own project.
Yeah.
So, I mean, controversy doesn't hurt.
Well, it can't help if you've fallen on the side of it, the majority of folks. In the state Senate race, we're going to see two folks who are unopposed in the primary. Jim Woodward, the Republican, is going to be opposed by Vera Gadman, the Democrat. I think Vera has been on the ballot before in previous elections. Zach or Michael, do you guys, is that accurate?
Question on that, is Vera Gadman going to be a placeholder, do you think, or is she running for reals?
My sense is she's a placeholder.
Yeah.
I don't know that for certain, but that's my sense. I've never heard of her.
Yeah, she's never responded in previous elections to request interviews. She doesn't campaign. And by placeholder, we mean she could withdraw. The Democratic Party could appoint somebody to run for that seat, correct? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And Jim Woodward is a very popular, another one of these even-keeled, really sort of like stand-up people that no one can really have any problem with. I mean, he just does his job, and he's open and accessible, and he's of here, you know, he's got the pulse. I think Jim is definitely going back, and I'm personally very glad that he is. I like him.
He's the most moderate out of the Republican field, I would say.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Okay, in the state representative seat B that Sage Dixon just won on the Republican side, he's going to be versus Stephen Hallett. He's a Democrat. He lives up in Bonners Ferry. He's run against Sage, I believe, twice before without success.
Right.
Of course, again, Sage has the power of the R behind his name, along with Sage is probably, as we observed earlier, you know, has a lot of people that appreciate that he's accessible. Any insights on that race or prognostications?
I predict Sage will take that, but
yeah.
I mean, my guess is that, you know, Stephen Howlett is one of these people that just they run so that someone's running.
Yep.
And I think that's great. I think that every race should be contested, no matter what, right? It's interesting to me that a person in Boundary County would run as a Democrat. It's sort of a minor stirring, you know, of sort of party sentiment up there. There's no doubt that Sage Dixon's going to take it, but it's, at least there's going to be some minor debate, which is nice. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and in fact, let's put that out there. It really is important for the parties to put forward candidates so that they can kick off a debate on the issues that are important to our voters and residents. So it's a great service that these candidates provide when they'll stand up and run for office, even when the odds are stacked against them, because they can test the reasoning of the incumbents or their opponents. And that's important for the voters.
Mm-hmm. Well, politics is the conversation. And if there's only one person talking in the conversation, then, you know, everybody's in trouble.
It's pretty one-sided. Okay, let's talk about state representatives CA, which is, again, was uncontested in the primary. But in that race, it's going to be Heather Scott, the incumbent Republican, versus Gail Bolin. And again, I think Gail has had her name on the ballot previously. I'm not placing exactly what race that might have been. But any insights on that race?
You know, so I'm going to say this a little cavalier. I probably is more than I intend, but sometimes in politics, there's an entertainment value. And, you know, I would say this might be the closest for entertainment value of any of them that have occurred. That's just my comment, my observation. Love to hear your insights on that as well.
Zach, insights.
Well, I mean, Heather Scott is always, she's definitely our best legislator for headlines. like Bill was saying, like everything she does is news, and everything she says is news. And she might think that that's because she's being piled on, but it's really just because everything she says is newsworthy.
Yes.
That race will be interesting to watch. I know that Heather over the past year has come under a lot of more scrutiny than usual for her. That whole Rampart Group report that came out, you know, about Matt Shea and alleging domestic terrorism. And she featured very prominently in that report as one of
that's
his.
That's in Washington State, yeah.
Yeah, that was Washington. Yeah, the Washington State Representative Matt Shea, who I guess is not running for re-election, but has accepted a job in a church somewhere in eastern Washington. And I also heard rumors that he may be moving to Idaho, but that's unconfirmed. Regardless. Yeah, rumored, reports say. But, I mean, none of that stuff has stuck to Heather. It's only made her base more excited about her. So for entertainment value, yes, I think that's probably a good way to put that.
Okay. I'll mention that there are two races that are going to be uncontested on the general election ballot. That's Jeff Connolly for Commissioner District 2. He has no Democratic opponent. As well as prosecuting attorney Lewis Marshall. He, again, is going to be unopposed on the general election ballot. That leaves one last race to talk about. We only have a couple minutes now, but that's county sheriff. Darrell Wheeler looked like he was going to have a free pass. He's the Republican incumbent. And late in the game, a write-in candidate came, got her name, not on the ballot, so she was a write-in, but she put her name, I don't know what the proper term is, Michael, but she was qualified for the vote, and that's Cindy Marks as a Democrat. And Cindy Marks received 518 write-in votes yesterday. And that means she'll be on the general election ballot, correct, Michael?
Correct. Yeah, the surprise on this, and I'm not going to make any prognostications on winning or losing. As my job as a chief election officer, that's like patently poor taste for me to do. But one thing that an observation of this one, I was shocked that a write-in got that many votes. There were actually 650 or 700 write-in slots on her name, but many of them were Barack Obama, Eric Holder, Mickey Mouse, all those, and obviously they don't count. But I was surprised that 518 number is actually huge for a write-in candidate. They have to get the word out, and people have to affirmatively write that name from scratch. And so that was a surprise.
Yeah. Just for got about 60 seconds, Zach, any observations on the sheriff's race that will be coming up?
I think what Mike just pointed out, you know, that people had to affirmatively vote for Cindy speaks to sort of the controversial nature of the sheriff's race. I mean, Sheriff Wheeler has definitely gotten himself out in front of a couple of political issues, partisan political issues in recent months, from the governor's reopening orders to, you know, the festival gun lawsuit. He's made himself a political actor, and clearly there's some people out there who are not approving of his political stance, and they want somebody else. I think we're going to see a much more partisan debate around that race going into November.
Bill, any insights on the sheriff's race?
Yeah, you know, still as a new resident here, it was interesting to observe the sheriff and his take on the recent issues, most notably regarding the COVID virus and his position on that. I think it was very interesting to, you know, listen to his remarks. It's also interesting to observe the followers that remain, and to the point that there are people who are taking proactive steps to write in on the ballot. I do think that means that people are looking for something different. So it will be interesting to see how this plays out. It's way too soon for me to tell.
Yeah, and again, just the fact that there is an opponent for that particular race, it's a service to the constituents, the voters out there. They can hear the issues debated by from different points of view, and that will actually help inform the conversation. And you know what? Michael Rosedale, Bonner County Clerk, Bill Davis, Bonner County Daily Bee, Zach Hagedorn, Sandpoint Reader, we're out of time now. I just want to say thank you both. Thank all three of you for coming on board and talking with us today. And Michael, we'll give you the last word here. Anything you want to tell people about voting in November?
No, but do vote. I'm proud of our citizens for actually turning out like they did for this election. It was more than I thought, more than historical records. And please turn out again. No matter what party you are, who you are, make sure your voice is heard. That's what this whole thing is about.
Great. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Zach. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for our show today. If you've just tuned in, you've been listening to Community Conversations on 88.5 KRFY and our interview and analysis of the primary election that concluded on June 2nd. I'm Chris Bessler. Be sure to tune in each Tuesday and Thursday at 8 a.m. for more Community Conversations. If you happen to miss all or part of a show, remember you can hear the recorded podcast on our website at www.krfy.org and click to our podcast page. Thank you for listening today.